4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we explore what it means to be living in the new geologic age. I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today we'll be featuring an interview with Professor Andy Hoffman. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Leslie, and today my guest is Andy Hoffman. He's the director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. So thank you so much for joining us today, Andy.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah. I was looking up your resume. You have a really impressive resume, and it looks like you've been all over, like the EPA. You've worked in environmental consulting, and now you're in academia. So I was wondering if you could kind of just run me through how you got to where you are today.
Well, I started at the EPA, spent 2 years there, decided I didn't like the government. Just wasn't my cup of tea. Actually went into building houses. I was a general contractor of high-end custom homes for 4 years. Went back to grad school, and environmental issues were really becoming hot because business was doing it because they wanted to, not because regulation was forcing them to. And so I was offered a free ride to do a PhD at MIT and took it, and here I am. But I never would have expected to be here if you asked me this 20 years ago.
Yeah. Was your PhD in environmental science?
It was a dual degree in environmental engineering and business management.
And I saw that you've written a ton of books, like 9 or 10 now.
And Is that a ton?
sounds like a lot to me. and that the most recent book you worked on was the Oxford Handbook of Business and the Natural Environment.
That's right.
And it kind of deals with the intersection between business activity and environmental protection. So I was kind of curious, what makes the role of businesses unique in the environmental movement, and how big of a role do you think business can play now and into the future in protecting the environment?
Well, can I back up and sort of add a piece to this question that I think is important? When I first started working on this issue in 1995, environmental issues in business schools were not really legitimate. I got turned down for a job at a top-tier business school saying, we love your stuff on institutional theory, which is my area, but I think it's too focused on the environment. There was a lot of skepticism that people who focused on the environment were advocates. They weren't objective scientists. And now the field has become legitimate. It's a legitimate area of empirical inquiry. So this handbook is significant because what it's doing is pulling together the past roughly 17 years of research on business and the natural environment. Where have we been? Where are we now? Where are we going? And it's really a place marker to say that the field is now a legitimate one. So I think that's important. So that's on the academic side. So you can have a career in academia studying business environmental issues. When I first started, it was sketchy. It was tricky. The practical question you ask, what is the role of business on environmental issues? The reality is that the most powerful institution on earth is business. If business is not developing solutions to our sustainability issues, they won't be developed. They develop the drivetrain that's under the hood of the automobile sitting out there in the parking lot. They'll devise the next form of mobility, whatever that may be. The clothes you're wearing, the building we're in right now, everything that we do, everything that we touch, everything that makes our life possible is created by business. And so if business is not part of the solution, there will be no solution.
Yeah, I think the role of business is certainly very interesting, although I feel like there's also this kind of divide between environmental scientists and business. You know, business is often seen as being a bad guy, you know, driving for profits and kind of putting environmental issues on the back burner. And then there's also an issue of greenwashing these days with some businesses. So do you think that there is a relationship that needs to be mended there between business and environmental scientists, and if so, how would we go about doing that?
There is an interesting split within the environmental NGO community, the non-governmental organizations. It's termed bright greens and dark greens. The bright greens look at the market as the solution, business as allies. so Environmental Defense Fund, NRDC, WRI. The dark greens look at the market as the problem and business as the enemy. Greenpeace, Earth First, Earth Liberation Front, PETA. They each have a role to play. One is about purity, the dark greens. One is about pragmatism, the bright greens. One is about consensus. One is about conflict. And they each make the conversation possible. You need the dark greens out there throwing rocks, criticizing, pointing out the problems, and then you have the bright greens out there facilitating solutions and collaboration. They both are necessary. So I don't think you need to necessarily mend the fence. What you need to do is recognize that they're both part of the mosaic of driving change.
Okay, and why do you think that both are necessary?
Well, there's a nice idea from the political science literature called the radical flank effect. And it goes something like this. It was used for the civil rights movement, to understand the civil rights movement. And imagine it like this. You got Martin Luther King out there with his message. And it was too radical for white America. They choked on the message. They wouldn't accept it. Until Malcolm X came along, and he pulled the flank way out. So all of a sudden people said, maybe Martin Luther King isn't so bad, because that Malcolm X, he's way too radical for us. So in the environmental movement, you can have the same effect. There's a wonderful line by Russell Train, who was the second administrator of the EPA. And it was around the time David Brower was really doing his thing. And he was a real tough guy. He was a real bad boy in the environmental movement. And Russell Train had a wonderful quote to capture this effect. He said, "Thank God for the David Browers of the world. They make the rest of us seem reasonable." Now, he's not knocking David Brower, but he's recognizing that he's pulling the flank way out there so that what used to be seen as a fringe is now mainstream. And that allows change to happen.
Gosh, I never heard that before. That's really interesting.
It is.
Yeah. Another question that I had dealing with the private sector is that, you know, climate change is a worldwide problem, but the private sector looks really different across countries across the globe. So, you know, is it possible for the private sector to bring about positive environmental changes across the board, across the globe, from both, you know, highly industrialized countries like the U.S. and more third world countries?
Mm-hmm. Multinational corporations operate in many different regulatory environments, Europe, Asia, North America, South America, and so forth. And they don't like to have multiple standards. Whirlpool does not want to have to make one type of washing machine for the United States, a different one for Mexico, a different one for Europe. So they can be a normalizing force, the multinationals. So that's on the sort of the proactive push side. But I also think it's interesting that big branded companies that go global become juicy targets for environmental NGOs and activists. Think about Apple in China, Nike in China, Coca-Cola in India. These kinds of pressures were possible because they're big branded companies. If it was Joe's Soda Company in India, then the movement about what they were doing to the water table, it wouldn't have resonated it on college campuses around the country. If it was, Fred's sneaker company making sneakers in China, no one would have cared that they were using sweat, you know, slave labor. The fact that it was Nike or Coca-Cola allows pressure to come to bear and forces a response that ripples up and down the supply chain. And so these multinationals have a very important role to play. It is also important to recognize the other side of it, and that is that, these companies have tremendous power when they go into developing countries, and sometimes they can dictate deals that are not in the best interests of the environment or the local people, for that matter. And then you brought up the idea of greenwashing, and I think we have to be careful when we look at corporate action. Sometimes it's substantive. They do it for a reason. So the Toyota Prius, is that a green product? No. That's their future market segment. They're not going to drop it. When profits go south, they're banking on that technology. So they're really doing it. There are companies that will do things for symbolic reasons. They'll do it because that's what you're supposed to do. That's fine, too. I don't care if they get it as long as they do it. Then there's greenwashing, which is the deliberate misrepresentation of what they're doing. That's problematic. But we don't want to confuse symbolic action where they're doing the right thing, but they may not be doing it for exactly the right reasons. I don't care as long as they do it.
I think this issue of the language of environmental problems, of people getting green fatigue, is a really interesting one. You know, words like sustainability or green jobs or green energy, you know, that doesn't really have too much meaning for people anymore. So I'm wondering if you think that there's a way that we can get around this. Like, do we need to have a shift in language in order to be able to talk about these issues more effectively?
Mm-hmm. Let me talk about my more recent work, which is common with Susie Mosier, of the social debate over climate change. We have a scientific consensus. Those aren't my words. That's the words of the National Academies of Sciences, American Association for the Advancement of Science. They call it a consensus. The scientific agencies of 90 countries, every one of the G8 plus 5 say this is something, but we don't have a social consensus. And the problem right now is that climate change has become politicized. It's become a right-left issue. So what do you do about that? Well, there's a number of things you can do. One is you find better frames. People do hear climate change. They do. These wheels start turning in their head, and they either turn on or turn off to the issue. But how can you frame climate change as an issue of economic competitiveness? That's what Thomas Friedman's talking about. If we don't develop the next round of technology, China's going to do it. We're going to be buying it from China. You can talk about it as national security. There's a group called the CNA Group that said that climate change is a threat multiplier, and it will create greater instability in certain regions of the world. The U.S. military will have to go in and start to stabilize regimes. It's going to create refugees. It's a problem. The Vatican is going carbon neutral. They look at this issue as one of social justice and social equity. The poor people of the world are going to be hit first and hardest, and that's not right. So you try and find frames that will resonate with people in the language that they're comfortable with, and then you also try and find messengers that they're comfortable with. Al Gore gets some people back up. They don't trust him at all. Rush Limbaugh, exact opposite effect. There's a study by John Krosnick at Stanford to show that increasing viewership of Fox News correlates with decreasing belief in climate change. He hasn't done the study, but I'm willing to bet that if you did the same thing with people who listen to NPR, you'll find the exact opposite correlation. So who do we bring in that has credibility on both sides? Well, where are the conservative Republican politicians? Where are they on climate change? Bob Inglis, John Warner, they're trying to make this issue a Republican issue. Where are religious leaders? Where are the evangelicals? Where are certain media sources? You know, we need to get a broader kind of spokesman out there.
It seems like one of the advantages of the private sector is that it isn't necessarily on the political spectrum. And so, you know, it's kind of like an independent, what's the word I'm looking for?
Broker?
Entity, yeah.
Yes and no. In a business school, when I teach about these issues, I am not teaching corporate social responsibility. I feel that when you do that, you are telling your students, go to your other classes, learn how to maximize NPV, ROI, ROA. Come to my class, I'm going to teach you a different value set. That's not sustainable. But I teach it as corporate strategy. I teach it as a market shift. In a market shift, there are winners and there are losers. And certainly there are companies out there that are losers in a carbon-constrained world. Coal. Fossil fuels, they are not going to go down lightly. They are going to resist what they are doing. And then there are companies that will benefit. You know, GE with its Eco Imagination program, they're not wrapping their arms around a tree and doing this. They're recognizing that in a carbon-constrained world, you need more efficient turbines, more efficient jet engines, nuclear power plants. Hey, guess what? GE makes those things. They will actually benefit in a carbon-constrained world. That's where they're looking.
I want to kind of bring it back to your current research on the cultural and institutional roots of environmental problems. I thought that was a really interesting phrase. And I was wondering if you could just give us some examples of some of those cultural and institutional roots in the U.S. that contribute to environmental problems. Like, are we talking about the culture of having a house and 2.5 kids and living in the suburbs and then therefore having to drive a lot and owning a car, those sorts of things?
Certainly. Everything you described is about technology. Technology is intimately tied with culture. Technology is only the proximate cause of our environmental problems. Our culture tells us what technology to develop, and then once it's developed, it changes our culture. It's a circular relationship. And so when we think about certain issues, so the issue that I've been focusing on is climate change. I think climate change is an extreme case. Therefore, it exposes these deeper value issues that are actually embedded within most environmental issues. So, you know, does nature have inherent value? Some people say yes. Some people say no. That is a deep issue within the climate change debate. It's also within ANWR. Should we leave ANWR alone? Most people will never go there. But people say it's sacred. Leave it alone. That goes all the way back to the Hetch Hetchy in California, just east of here. When San Francisco had its big fire, the mayor said, we need a stable water supply. He looked to the east. There's the Hetch Hetchy Valley. It looks just as beautiful as Yosemite. Perfect site for a dam. And Teddy Roosevelt had to decide. And on one side was John Muir saying this is a sacrilege. There's inherent value there. To dam the Hetch Hetchy, he said, is the same as to dam St. Peter's. It's you can't do it. On the other side is Gifford Pinchot saying this is nonsense. It's the greatest good for the greatest number. There's a utilitarian value here. There's no inherent value. This is craziness. There is the tension, and the tension still exists now. But within the climate change debate, there's a whole host of deep value issues. Phrase it this way. Think about the central question of climate change. Do you believe that we as a species have grown to such number and our technology to such power that we can alter the global climate? If you answer that question yes, that really changes a lot about how you view the world. One, it changes the moral order. Who's in charge out there? Is it God and divine providence? Actually, no, it's us. That threatens some people's beliefs in God, you know. And I've had some, I get climate skeptic hate mail, and I've had one person, obviously you don't believe in God, because only God can change planets. Well, I'm not so sure that's true anymore. If you believe that question is true, then it has a new form of global ethics. Does your mowing your lawn here in Santa Cruz have import for the poor people of Bangladesh? If you believe climate change is real, then the answer is yes. We are not, as a species, ready to go there. And then, what kind of controls do we have? Well, we need some kind of global governance. Now some people start to hear one world government. They start to hear totalitarianism. Thank you very much. mention the UN. Is that one world government? You're really going to set people some off. So, you know, and in this country right now, we do have a raging debate over the proper role of government. Climate change runs smack into that, because to deal with this issue, you're talking about reducing CO2, you're talking about impacting energy availability, energy prices, energy sources, energy use, which goes to the core of how we live. It's a deeply cultural question.
Yeah, so it sounds like we've reached a scientific consensus on climate change, but not a social consensus.
Exactly.
But so how do we get to that social consensus if there are so many warring cultural roots and values?
Well, it's a natural thing to happen. Think about the cigarette debate. For decades, scientists said cigarettes cause cancer. I would add parenthetically that to this day, we can't prove that cigarettes cause cancer. If you look at the Surgeon General's report, it says epidemiologically, we can show you how it can happen. Statistically, how it will probably happen, but quote-unquote, in the end, it's a matter of judgment. The IPCC says that humans are the likely cause of climate change in this world right now. They're never going to be able to come up with that smoking gun. Science just isn't designed to do that. But it's natural. So scientists for decades said cigarettes cause cancer, and for decades, society rejected that notion. Tobacco industry pushed back with its own scientists, with a whole set of campaigns that are very similar to what's going on right now on climate change. It requires a long-term discussion. Now, it raises the question of whether the natural environment is on the same time scale as our social change, but I would add that culture does not change in a straight line linear fashion. It can go through sudden discontinuities. And, you know, there's an uptick in belief in climate change right now because of the weird weather we've had this year. In Michigan alone, we had a very, very strange early spring, February, freakish, and then we had a cold snap. The numbers I've started to hear is that we're going to lose upwards of 90% of our cherry crop because of that. That's going to change people's beliefs in a step function, not in a linear function. So this debate is important. It's necessary. You know, people get frustrated, but we've only been tackling this for about 10 or 15 years, and you're talking about a massive change in our culture. It's going to take a lot longer than that.
Do you think that if Americans knew about the scientific process, that regardless of what community leaders were saying, that more people would believe in climate change?
Well, the reality is that you don't need people to understand the intricacies of climate science. That's just too much to expect. What you need to have them do is trust the scientific process. And the reality is they do. They do it every time they go to the hospital. They do every time they help their son or daughter with their science homework. Every time they turn on a car, that's possible because of science. Our entire world is possible because of science, the way we live. And there's a nice way to phrase it. I heard a sociologist talking about this, that we get through our worlds every day by activating black boxes. And if we knew what was in those black boxes, we'd become crippled. I get in my car, turn it on. I have no idea what happened under the hood, but it works. It gets me there. I'm going to go to San Francisco Airport tomorrow. There's going to be a huge, complex air traffic control system and a very complex jet that's going to drop me back in Detroit. I have no idea how it works, but it's going to get me there. I live my day by activating black boxes. I have no idea what's going on inside this electronics in front of us right now. And if I needed to know the intricacies of everything I did, there's not enough time in the day. And this is where some of the challenges come in just educating the public. There's a lot of people who believe, well, the market will correct itself if you just give people, quote-unquote, perfect information. If you label all products in terms of their environmental impact, I don't believe that's true. People are limited in their ability to grab information, process it, deal with it, act on it, and just flooding people with information is not going to work.
Yeah, I listened to an interview you did recently where you were talking about how giving people more information about climate change and the science behind it doesn't necessarily change their opinion one way or another.
Yeah. And along that's getting to a different thing, though. That if that gets back to the idea that this is a cultural issue. If belief in climate change becomes associated with liberal ideals, which it has, then if you're a true conservative, you're just going to reject it out of hand. There's a nice book out right now by Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind, and the big point there is that when we're faced with complex and uncertain situations or decisions, our intuition and our emotions kick in first, and we'll make a decision, and then our rational mind will follow later to look for information to confirm that position. And so on climate change, if it's associated with liberal ideals, then a conservative is going to just flat out, I'm not going to believe it, and I'm going to look for information to support that. If you keep hammering them with more data, you're failing to recognize that they have to become culturally inconsistent to accept that, and they will actually dig their heels in even harder. They will resist even more if you just hammer them with data, because what in effect you're saying is, you don't get it? Well, here's more data. You still don't get it? What's wrong with you? Here's some more data. And you keep banging on that door when their resistance is up because I think Al Gore is an opportunist, because I think that scientists are corrupt, because I think that the UN is whatever. All these things are actually what the conversation is about. I like to say that the social debate over climate change is not about climate change at all. It's about deeper values and cultural norms.
I guess I kind of want to talk a little bit about like the personal changes that people feel they have to make in order to kind of play their part to mitigate climate change and the inconvenience of that. I think a lot of people, people are like, oh, well, if it's inconvenient for me, I don't want to have to deal with that. Like, I have a car, I'll drive, I don't want to take the train, things like that.
Well, individual virtue is great. I want people to do that, to have a strong sense of personal purpose and authenticity in their life. I don't think that will solve the problem, per se. If everyone, people start screwing in LED light bulbs and buying organic food. In terms of shifting the market, I think that's minor. In terms of shifting the culture, I think it's major. And as people start to change their practices, they start to change their beliefs, not the other way around. You don't sit down in the morning and say, I'm going to believe X. You start to change your behavior, and then the beliefs start to follow. And hopefully that will translate into voting patterns, into telling others. If you took your house right now and made it zero energy, impact on the global climate, small. Impact on your neighbors and your community, huge. And that's where the change starts to happen. So that's where I think individual actions are critically important, is just to change our culture and to change the way we think and how we view the world around us and our place within it.
Do you think there has to be a certain consciousness to that behavioral change? Because I know there's sustainability research that's going on now around behavior change, just based on unconscious decisions.
Yeah. Well, culture is, at the deepest level, the tacit assumptions we have about how the world works, things we don't question. And we start to change the structures of our society, and out of those changes come a shift in the tacit beliefs. For example, you can go back to the 1960s and, you know, dumping hazardous waste in the back 40, that was okay. That was what we did. We dumped at sea. We did all kinds of craziness. And now, not only do we not do it, but we actually look and say, that was pretty strange. That's really thoughtless. It's not correct. Think about litter. You know, I love watching the show Mad Men. And there's an episode where they go on a picnic. And they finish the picnic, and the lead character takes his blanket and just shakes it, and all the garbage goes flying. He finishes his beer and just chucks the can into the woods. That was okay. Today, if someone did that, you'd look at them like, what's wrong with you? That's a shift in consciousness. That's a shift in culture. And so as we start to think about shifting our beliefs around climate change, it gets back to something you said earlier. It starts to run up against some things like, quote-unquote, the American dream. The American dream is your McMansion with a big lawn of invasive species and your SUV in the driveway. What will it take for the American dream to start to shift towards perhaps urban living in a walkable environment, in an energy-efficient home? That, to me, is about culture change. And I do think that there is a shift away from suburbia as, I mean, it's not the majority by any means, but cities are seeing a rebirth because people like the idea of actually going home, parking the car, and be able to go for a walk with your wife and kids and grab some food, catch a movie, do what you need to do. And you know, it's a whole movement in architecture called New Urbanism. That's about a shift in consciousness. That's about a shift in beliefs.
All right. Well, very good. Thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure.
I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/Anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?